IIE Financial is an investment advisor representative with Symphony Financial, a registered investment advisor. Charles Fulkerson is an investment advisor representative with IIE Financial and Symphony Financial, LTD Co. Annie Fulkerson is not registered nor affiliated with Symphony Financial. Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of Symphony Financial. The topics discussed and opinions given are not intended to address the specific needs of any listener. IIE Financial does not offer legal or tax advice. Listeners are encouraged to discuss their financial needs with the appropriate professional regarding your individual circumstance.
You're listening to Checking In on Finance. Willing the girl a nettle.
We are officially in a correction territory. Bulls and bears are split based upon fears and fundamentals. Welcome, everybody, to Checking In on Finance, brought to you by IIE Financial. IIE Financial, willing the good of another. I am your host, Chuck Fulkerson, joined by the way better looking than me. And smarter than me.
Than I, actually.
And I have to say that because she's married to me. Because if I don't, then I'm really in trouble.
I had to silently correct your grammar.
See, we have we drink a lot of coffee in our house, and she has a mug.
Coffee.
It's not coffee. Coffee is in New Jersey. You are not in New Jersey. You are in Texas.
I am.
Y'all better recognize. No, but she has a mug that says, silently correcting your grammar. And she likes to, you know, she gives me that look. You know that look? I mean, every husband knows that look. That look that you make when you slurp your coffee and just look over top of me with the glass.
I do. That Please look, don't do it into the
that
microphone.
That look where you're like.
No. Don't do it into the microphone. Oh, you just, every listener just turned us off.
No, they didn't. They know what's up. But they know you're giving that look like where your eyes are kind of peeking up over top. So I think a lot of people were drinking coffee this week. I think a lot of people were drinking other things this week.
Mm-hmm.
It was a
shoot tequila kind of week.
It was a scary week for
a lot of investors. If you didn't have a plan, it was a shoot tequila kind of week.
You know, it was a scary week for a lot of investors. And I will tell you, a number of the investors that I spoke to decided that it was probably a little bit more volatile than they wanted to be after strong up moves. We had a little over a 10% correction in the market. We had 2 days last week that were over 4%, and we had the two biggest down days in the history of the market on a pure points basis.
Yeah, no, but when you're talking percentages, the higher the market is, the bigger the number is going to be for the same percentage correction.
That's exactly it, yep.
You know, so when the market was at 10,000, you know, years ago, a 2% correction is a far different number than a 2% correction when the market's at almost 30,000.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's what we talk about so much. We beat the drum on this show so much about, and it is the core of the philosophy of our investment strategy, is to have a line in the sand and to have a plan. And you, when the market is this high, corrections need to account for the volatility in the market and what those percentage pullbacks are going to be, and looking for fair priced areas. And so, you know, 1,000 points is a lot. But at the same time, look at the trajectory of the price chart that we've seen over the last 2 years.
Oh, yeah. And it went straight up. And so I think the thing that really scared people and scared a lot of investors was that this was the single fastest 10% drop in the market since 1928.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a 10% drop that's almost unheard of overall, right? We had a huge decline in 87, but in 87, we'd already begun a little bit of a downward move before that, the one-day drop. But this is the biggest, this is the biggest 200-day moving average touch, the quickest ever. In like since 1928, and that almost never happens.
Those previous drops did not have as steep of an incline up either, though.
No, they didn't, and that's one of the things that, you know, if you take and just look at the charts, because we always look at the charts and we look at the angle of which it went up, it has almost never gone up as fast as it did. There was one brief period in 97, and what this reminds me of, I do believe, you know, there's the battle right now between fear and fundamentals, and I do believe that fundamentals will win. I do. Something tells me, though, that this week we could see the market continue to go down a little bit. I think there's still room for us to fall a little bit more because there's a fair amount of strong support a bit below us in the market. A bit below us, there's a lot more strong support, which could act as a short-term floor.
Yeah. And you just 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, we had you had written an article that equities.com published, and we had posted it on our page. You can go on our website if you want to read Chuck's article about market bubbles. But this, you know, you had been talking about this for weeks that, you know, we were anticipating, you know, a pullback like this. And when we're in correction territory, the theory behind corrections is that it could extend all the way to 19%.
Yeah, I mean, we can stay in a correction until 19%. Once you reach 20%, you're officially in bear market territory.
Right.
So, and a correction in February isn't really that big of a deal on the grand scheme of things. I will tell you, though, I have a number of investors that we just said, we're out. We're pulling the line in the sand, and we can always get back in. See, that's the beautiful thing about the way the markets work today. 30 years ago, getting in and getting out, you couldn't do it very efficiently, very quickly, because there was high commission costs. It took longer to get your money in and out. Nowadays, you can get in and out almost instantaneously. So if we get out of the markets because it's starting to go down and we've got a lot of fear and it doesn't keep falling, let's say it starts to go back up, can always get back in, right? Can always get back in. And even if you're only out for a couple of days, just to allow some of the fear to alleviate, that's okay. But if you hold on too long and then, you know, we get, let's say that we get three more days next week of 1,000 points down. Well, now all of a sudden we go from having a 10% correction to a 23% correction. And now people are
now
really
we're in bear market
worried.
Territory.
Right. And now people are really worried. So I'd rather err on the side of caution and bail too early than get in too late. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And especially with the investment strategy that, you know, at IIE Financial that we use, you know, with when you're trading with low fee products like ETFs, you're talking about a couple dollars, right? You're not talking about
$5 in, $5 out.
Right. So it's not as big of a deal as other products that other advisors use where they're looking at a percentage of your portfolio, whether it, you know, be mutual funds and things like that. So it's not as big of a deal when you're trading with technicals and having that line in the sand and having that plan where you're getting out for $5, you know, and then and then you can look for another quantitative high probability place to, you know, to rejoin the market.
Yeah, and corrections will shake out a lot of the speculative investors that have jumped in at the last minute. And what it'll do is it'll give value investors a chance to get in at a lower price.
Exactly. So fear is driving, you know, if the market continues to fall, fear can drive the market down and then smart money comes in and buys at value.
That's exactly it. You buy it at a lower cost basis in order to increase your overall return when inevitably it'll go back up. Now, why will it inevitably go back up? Because it has to. The market itself, the S&P 500, the Dow Jones, they're indexes that are made up of companies that are handpicked to go into those indexes. Now, when a company is underperforming, they take it out of the measurement and they put a new one in. You know, that's why ExxonMobil and that's why U.S. Steel, I was thinking of the ticker symbol X, that's why U.S. Steel and Alcoa and Citigroup are no longer in the Dow. They were removed and they were replaced with things like Apple and things like Travelers Insurance and things like Cisco. You know, one of the things that I wouldn't be surprised is if we start to see, you know, serious talk about the next kind of companies that are going to go into the Dow Jones. And there's a lot of people that are looking at the Dow Jones every day that may not even realize everything that's in there, right? Amazon's not in the Dow Jones. Who's to say that Amazon won't be added to the Dow Jones? What happens if you take out a poor performer like GE and you put in NVIDIA, right? Now, all of a sudden, if you take out GE and you put in NVIDIA, and NVIDIA is a, you know, it's a growth stock, it's gone booming in price, and GE has completely fallen and catered, all of a sudden, now you've strengthened the Dow. So inevitably, we know that it will go back up over time. The key is, how far down does it go, and does a value investor take the time to get into it a bit later?
Yeah. And I think too, when you, there was an interesting chart that I found on CNBC that they had posted. It was the S&P 500 since World War II. And it talked about the time of recovery, the length of the corrections, and then the time of recovery. And you know, we always talk about that line in the sand because we don't believe in riding it all the way down. And when we were looking at this chart, it talked about the corrections, which is up to and including 19%, right? And the average since World War II was in corrections was 13%, and the length was 4 months, and the recovery was 4 months. So great, right?
Right.
But once you get past that, the average bear market was 30%.
Right.
Right. And the length was 13 months, but the recovery was 22 months.
Right.
So
see, it goes back to the old adage, the market takes the elevator down and the stairs back up.
Mm-hmm.
It takes the elevator down and the stairs back up. And so what we want to be able to do is to that line in the sand, the whole reason that it exists is to have that, okay, if the elevator's going down, I'm going to get off before it falls too many floors.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to take that 50% hit. I, you know, I was speaking to an investor yesterday, and I've known him for a number of years. He was actually one of my students, as I used to travel around the world teaching people, you know, kind of do-it-yourself investors. And he was one of my students, and he told me, he says, you know, Chuck, I'm just not in the position in my life anymore to take another 50% hit. I lost 50% of my portfolio in 2000. I lost 57% in 2008. I'm just not ready to do that again. And so, you know, the reason I was speaking to him was because he saw all this occurring and said, how can we protect ourselves and what can we do? And really what it comes down to is understanding a plan and having a plan and knowing what your plan is going to be in order to kind of keep you safe and keep you out of the market. If you don't know what your plan is, feel free to give us a call. See if we can help you identify your plan. We're not going to help. We may not be the right fit for everybody as their advisor, but we can certainly at least point you in the right direction and give you some sort of a plan. So pop by the website, IIEfinancial.com, fill out the contact us form, and then we will talk to you a little bit about it. So let's talk about some news headlines today that are leading the market. And we're going to talk certainly about financial headlines and what the market headlines are, but we're going to start with news of the weird. Weird, 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 weird. And this isn't really news of the weird today. It's news of the awesome. Because yeah. I think back, you know, one of my favorite cartoons as a kid, you remember the Jetsons?
Of course.
Meet the Jetsons. Do, 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 do. Mm-hmm. I can't sing the song, but I remember the Jetsons. And one of my favorite things about the Jetsons, when you think about the Jetsons, right, what does it make you think of?
Flying cars.
Flying cars. Everybody thinks of flying cars. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever thinks of Rosie the Robot. Which, by the way, Rosie the Robot, why did she have to wear an apron and a little maid hat? She's a robot. Did she really need an apron?
I don't know. I want a flying car, though.
Yeah, but I want a flying mm-hmm. car. So this week in our news of the weird, we had a flying car.
We sure did.
Flying car. I saw a meme that said, it showed a map of the world and it had the U.S. colored green and it said, nations with flying cars, nations without.
Yeah, this week, SpaceX launched its most powerful rocket ever. And it looked amazing. So the Falcon Heavy, which is what it's called, became the most powerful commercial rocket in the world on Tuesday. It completed its maiden flight from NASA's Kennedy Space Center, which is so cool, in Florida. And it contained a Tesla Roadster. And it's currently orbiting around the sun.
And then they drove that Tesla Roadster around the Earth. Like they took a picture of it above, I think it was Australia.
Yeah, yeah, it's so cool. And there's lots of plans for the rest of this year. It's booked. It took like seven years to build, and $90 million, something crazy like that. But it's the cheapest rocket that's ever built, and it's the highest capacity and weight. And so for the rest of the year, it's booked to put commercial satellites into space and stuff like that. So it's just really cool. Really cool space news.
So I got to tell you, if I could have a flying car, I would have no problem living in any city in America because I wouldn't have to worry about traffic. See, if we had flying cars, though, the question would be, how long would it be until we had flying traffic jams?
Mm.
Like, you're just hovering there, just annoyed.
Yeah.
And then if you litter, then what happens to all the stuff out the window? It just gets terrible. You know, flying cars bring their own set of problems instead of troubles. No, but seriously, I think some of the stuff that Tesla is doing with the SpaceX program is absolutely amazing. But the Tesla stock, you know, interestingly, looking at the Tesla stock, it has lost money on every single quarter. 11 of the past 12 quarters, it has negative earnings growth. Mm-hmm. Yet the stock is still a super high-performing stock because, you know, they're just pumping more money back into R&D. Mm-hmm. And the people that believe in Tesla are firm believers that that thing is going to eventually just kind of, well, I mean, eventually. It's gone from 2013 when it was a $50 a share to over $300 a share now. Mm-hmm. There's people, though, that think that Tesla is easily a $1,000 a share company and then some.
Yeah. And what they've done is really impressive. I mean, the rocket itself has 5 million pounds of thrust, which doesn't mean much to most people, but that's the equivalent of about 18 Boeing 747 airplanes at takeoff.
Holy crud.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla.
Or a punch from Mike Tyson to the jaw.
Maybe. But Elon Musk has described it as the most powerful rocket in the world by a factor of 2.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and the payload is estimated to be nearly 3 times that of former space shuttles, which is really amazing. I mean, in a former life, I worked for NASA, and we were looking at nuclear technology to get, to power space shuttles to get from Earth into the outer reaches of space. And payload was always a very big concern. How much can you put in that rocket in order to, you know, actually get it off the ground with the thrust capacity that you have? So it's really, really impressive, you know, what they've done. Plus, they launched a car into space. So
can I just hear you use the word thrust capacity again? Yeah. That's engineer talk. So yeah. What other cool headlines caught your eyes this week? I know that I had some, and most of them are certainly going to be around the market correction. But what other headlines caught your eyes this week for things to talk about?
Really, I think the play-by-play of how all of the different fiscal and monetary policies have sort of dovetailed and come to a head. You know, you've talked before about how, you know, eventually the chickens have to come home to roost.
Right.
And, you know, with the 3 rate hikes that we've seen that were scheduled, we've just about doubled, you know, the interest rates. And we do have strong fundamentals. We have a tax cut that's putting more money in most Americans' pockets, as estimated. But we do have these rate hikes. Inflation remains under control. And so the Fed has said that the 3 rate hikes scheduled for 2018, they're still planning on doing. And if inflation continues to remain under control, then they don't see a problem with rising interest rates again, you know, another rate hike in addition to the 3 that are already scheduled. And so what that does, we have bond prices falling, right? As interest rates go up, prices fall,
right?
And bond yields rise. And so far, like within the last 8 years, there really hasn't been any other place for investors to put their money other than the equities markets, right? Because bond yields have been so low. But now people have, you know, because there is pretty aggressive spending bill that has just been signed into law.
Yeah, that was pretty big.
Yeah, it was pretty big. A lot of the bondholders have decided to sell their bonds. And
right.
So we have bond yields rising and at a time when the market, you know, has fallen.
Well, and you've broken through for those people that ever look at charts, and I look at charts all the time. When you look at the technical charts, we have fallen through some major support on some of the 20-year notes. And a lot of people are getting a little concerned with some of the higher yield corporate bonds. So high yield corporate bonds are losing some of their value as well, simply because people are just pulling out of them. And so when you look at ETFs, exchange-traded funds, and I'm looking primarily at the funds, which are made up of high-yield bonds, they fell through a pretty strong floor level last week. And because a lot of investors, it's the skittish nature that an investor is going to have. And those all kind of dovetail in together. Interestingly enough, there was an article on MarketWatch, and the article was titled, The Dow dropped 1,000 points. How low can it go? And that was that article on MarketWatch was really about what's the worst case scenario, right? Brace yourselves for the worst case scenario. In here, there was a man named Jim Rogers, who's the chairman of Rogers Holding Inc. Now, what does that mean to anybody? Well, here's what it means. He founded the Quantum Fund in 1973 with a little guy named George Soros. Most people have heard of George Soros, ultra mega wealthy, you know, what do we call it? A go billionaire, a go billionaire. I'm making up a word. But he says his exact quote, he says, we're going to have a bear market again, and it will be the worst of our lifetime. Debt is everywhere and it's much, much higher now. He said, in theory, that would be more than the 54% drop in 2007 to 2009. So that's really his belief. Now, I think that that's a possibility, and I've talked about that in the past in articles that I've written and in, you know, a couple of things that we've talked about here on the show, but I think there's one more rally left up in this market.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've got another thrust up in this market. So what I see occurring, and once again, this is just one guy's opinion, right? And what is it? Opinions are like armpits. Everybody has one. They all stink, and some of them are hairy.
No, that's a nicer way to say it than I've ever heard it. But
we're gonna go with armpits.
Armpits.
Everybody has one. They all stink, and some of them are hairy. Well, I wouldn't be surprised to see the Dow come back down to around 22,000. That's really the number that, you know, sitting at about 24,000 now, I could see another 2,000 points coming in the Dow.
That's a good fair price area. Yeah, when you look at the technicals on the chart.
There's
for
a
sure.
fair price value area between 20 and 22,000. Call it 21. Let's just call it 21,000. There's a fair price value area on a monthly time period that looks like it makes a lot of sense. That looks like it would be the area where the market would possibly kind of come back into. And if we do come back into that region, you're going to get some more scared. So you're going to get some more people that are nervous, especially if it comes back to that region in the next week or two. And that, I think, is what scared people more than anything. It's not that the market went down. The markets go down, and people, you know, they kind of meander through it. But when it comes down so fast is really what caused the fright and what caused the scare.
Mm-hmm. And over the last 9 months, we've talked about that frog in the pot of boiling water analogy, how
right.
the Fed has been raising rates, right?
Yep.
And so we've had the Fed kind of slowly leaking out, you know, the, well, we're just going to raise, you know, the rates, and kind of like, it was like a soft, what do you call that?
A gentle raise.
Yeah, gentle raise, you know, kind of thing. And it's, you know, you put the frog in a pot of water and you slowly turn up the heat, right? And I think now the frog realizes that it's boiling.
The frog's time to go!
Yeah, you had the VIX at the lowest it's ever been, right? And you had a lot of investment vehicles like ETFs that were tied to that VIX. So a lot of it just came to a head, you know, and with all the bond prices
and in the planning segment, and in our planning segment this week, we'll talk a little bit about the VIX, right? What is volatility and how does it work? I think that helps a lot of people to understand, because a lot of this was algorithmic based trading that you're going to want to stay tuned in for that planning segment as we kind of go through that.
Yeah, I agree.
So if you don't. But what it really comes down to is if you don't have a plan for this and you don't know what's going to happen next, then it's going to become very difficult for you to be able to sustain some of these down market movements. So the key is have a plan, know your plan, and follow through. So what caused last week's market drop? What was the initial thing that caused and the catalyst that got things to move? It was all about volatility, and understanding volatility will really help to understand why the market did what it did, specifically around algorithmic trading. You're listening to Chuck and Anna Finance, brought to you by IIE Financial. IIE Financial, willing the good of another. Visit us online, IIEfinancial.com. Fill out the contact us and let us know if we can do anything to help you out in your investing needs. So, volatility. when we think about volatility, volatility is really the movement of the market up and down. And when we really look at the movement of the market up and down, that's volatility. Think about volatility as a ball that's going to bounce. And the more that ball bounces, the higher the volatility number is going to be. And well, if I throw, you know, we've heard the phrase a dead cat bounce. And with a dead cat bounce, that means that if you dropped a cat off the ceiling, how high would it bounce? Well, not that much. So a dead cat.
I'm not sure too many of our listeners are going to enjoy the fact that you just talked about a dead cat bouncing.
I think that they should because they can visualize it. First of all, who's never dropped a dead cat off a building?
Ooh.
Maybe I shouldn't admit that on radio. I'm just kidding. I've never dropped a dead cat. Don't turn me into PETA. No, I don't want those people on me. That's a subject for another show. But anyway, my point is that when we're looking at volatility, think of volatility like a rubber ball or like anything bouncing, hence the dead cat. When we have light volatility, when the volatility is light, we anticipate that the markets are going to bounce, but not too much, right? They're going to move between a small range. And we had really low volatility, especially the last half of 2017. And then our volatility started to increase, but it only increased in an upward direction in January. And so we started to see the expansion of volatility. And if anybody remembers, I had talked about this on the show a couple of weeks ago, that even though the market was going up, the VIX was also going up. Now, what is the VIX? So it's important for people to understand the VIX is what's called the volatility index. It measures the implied volatility of the S&P 500 options. Whoa, whoa, whoa. What in the world does that mean?
You got to break that down.
It basically measures the cost of insurance of the S&P 500. It's been called the fear gauge. Because what happens is people look at the VIX and it tells them if people are afraid about the market movement. And the VIX was at essentially all-time lows. So there was really no fear in the market at all. And that was really in October, November, December. Then in January, the markets continued to go up, but we actually saw the VIX rise a little bit. So what that meant was that the fear gauge was telling us, hey, we may want to pay attention here. There's some interesting things happening. And then the market started to fall apart. And I say fall apart, the markets came down. And we saw the VIX spike. Now, when the VIX spiked, there are a number of derivative trading vehicles based upon the VIX.
And when you say derivative trading vehicles, you're talking about trading vehicles that are based on something else other than like an underlying product, right?
That's exactly right. So a derivative trading vehicle is something that is not based upon its own pricing. It has something that it's tied to, right? So if you think about the way leverage works, when you tie something to something else and you know, think about a lever like a long pole, right? Or a pulley. I could lift a car if I have it on a chain and enough pulleys, right? If I've got enough leverage, I could lift a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of these volatility-based ETFs were linked to the VIX. Now, what happened is as the market started to fall, the VIX took a rise. So the VIX went from the low was 8, and that was back right around Thanksgiving. It got as high as almost 50. It actually got a little bit above 50 one day. The VIX got above 50, and on one day, the VIX went from 10 to 15. Now, 10 to 15 is a 50% increase in the VIX. We would expect to see a 50% increase in the VIX. Did the fear gauge rose by 50%? Well, it wound up going from 10 to 50. That's a 500% increase in our fear index that occurred in a span of a week. A 500% increase in our fear index. Now, the derivative products that are based upon that are the ones that took a big hit. Like, for example, there's an ETF, VXX, which is an ETF that tracks the VIX, the value of the VIX, and it went from $25 to $50. Actually, it went all the way as high as $56 in about 6 days. So it had a 100% increase. But the one that really was the one that really kind of threw people for a tizzy was XIV. Now, XIV is an ETF that is Credit Suisse Trackers. It's a short ETF, meaning it makes money as the VIX goes down. So it's a short fund. So a short fund means that as something goes down, it goes up.
It's an inverse correlation.
Inverse correlation. So to give you an example, from the beginning of 2017 to the end of 2017, it went from $47 a share up to $137 a share. Okay?
So it's mostly used as like an insurance or a hedge. Is that right?
It's a good way to put it.
Is that how a lot of people use it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So let's just give you an example. It from the middle of 2011 until 2017, it went from $5 a share up to $146 a share. So it took 6 years or so to go up to $140 a share. It was $146 a share back on January the 11th. It was $5 a share before it was finally, before it was finally all said and done. It got down to $5 a share. And at $5 a share, you don't really have a lot of value in there. In one day, it went from $98 a share down to $10 a share overnight. It's called a gap. It gapped. It closed one day at 98. It opened the next day at 5. And that was because it caused forced liquidation. Now, why did that happen? And here's really where it comes down to. This was algorithmic-based trading. And it was algorithmic-based trading because what happened is it's if-then statements in a computer. The computer said, if the VIX goes up, then we sell something. If this, then that. If this, then that. Well, the way that they hedge those, meaning insurance, the way that they protect those, is that they go out and they short, meaning that they bet against the S&P 500 futures market. So what they do is as that VIX starts to go up, these ETFs, these exchange-traded funds, which are heavily, heavily invested in these volatility-based products, in order to protect themselves, they go out and short the S&P so that they make money as the S&P falls. And that protects them from total liquidation and from totally falling apart. Well, the problem is that these computers kept shorting all these futures markets. And then that starts this domino effect of additional markets being hit, which then hits more VIX-related ETFs, which then continues the domino effect and it drives the markets down. That's really...
And then retail investors start to panic, driving the VIX up even further.
That's exactly it. And retail investors panic and it goes down further. So that's why on Monday, we got a 1,600-point Dow movement at one point that it fell. But then we got a big rally on Tuesday. Well, the rally that we got on Tuesday of last week was what's called a short covering rally. See, when somebody goes short, they sell short to open the position. To get into the trade, they've got to sell. Well, if you sell to get into a trade, how do you get out of it?
You have to buy.
You got to buy. See, so all the people that made money on the sale as it went down, then they had to buy in order to cover their shorts. Well, right.
And let me stop you for a second, because there might be a lot of, you're talking kind of technical stuff that the traditional investor may not understand. And so the old adage of buy low, sell high, what you're talking about really is just the reverse of that. So instead of first buying low and then selling high, what these investors are doing, these big money, smart investor, institutional people are, instead of buying low, selling high, they're selling high first and then buying low to get out of the position. So they're doing the reverse, and they're doing that to hedge their own position and leverage their own position that they're in.
Right. And so when they buy, anytime you buy, it causes prices to go up. Mm-hmm. So when they bought, it caused prices to rally, which is why people, oh, it's over. It's fine. Everything's going to be okay. And so on Tuesday, the market got that short covering rally, which made everybody feel a bit better. And then Wednesday, we kind of had a normalized day. It was still kind of a big day, but kind of normalized. And then Thursday, skadoosh, we came right back down. and that was really due to more short selling. And then Friday, what did we get? Another short covering rally.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, Friday, we got a friend of mine called it a face-ripping rally. And And so when we understand why these moves occur, what it does is it helps us to have a better handle of our personal investments, because it can allow you to keep calm and realize that once all these algorithms have gone through all their crap, that it should normalize. And that's why I believe that fundamentals trump fear in this particular situation. I think that the markets, you know, may settle down, may go even a bit lower. But as they go a bit lower, there's going to be a point where the institutional investors realize, the value investors step in and realize that it could be a good time to buy. And if you find where those points are, where it could be a good time to buy, maybe then you as an educated investor can then step in front without having quite so much fear and being tied to that fear index. Let's turn our attentions to the oil market, the energy market, natural gas market, and some of the things that are moving that entire market in general. And you found, Annie, a pretty cool article that you said that we should highlight on the show today, which I thought would be actually a good idea to do. So what was the article? Where can people find it? And give us some of the points on it.
It's actually on Forbes.com. It's talking about the keep it in the ground movement, quote unquote, the keep it in the ground movement of oil and natural gas. And I thought it was a really interesting article because of the market correction territory that we're in now.
I've got to stop you.
Yeah.
It's not keep it in the ground. Okay. I'm from Pittsburgh, and the way that we say it the right way is,
oh no,
yins keep it in a grand.
Oh my gosh. I hate that accent.
Keep it in a grand.
The Pittsburgh accent sounds like you forgot half of the alphabet exists.
Keep it in a grand.
Oh, it's a terrible accent.
So yeah, see, when I would
almost rather you pick just about any other accent, like worldwide, than that accent.
Yeah, you keep it in a grand. You can't go, yins can't go downtown. You need to go down John Eagle.
Pow, you go down a pants and a.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Anyway, I'm sorry. Carry on. So for those of you, by the way, anybody who's listening to this has never been to Pittsburgh, just go. Go to Primanti. It's called Primanti's.
Go
down the south side. Go down Primanti's. Get yourself a sandwich. And you'll be able to hear people talk like that. They'll say things like keep it in the ground.
That's right. Keep going. It's a cool sandwich. You stack every... It was originally created for the coal miners. It's a cool story.
It is. It's a great sandwich.
Because yeah, they didn't have time. The miners didn't have time to eat a sandwich and fries and coleslaw. So this one restaurant...
Throw it all together.
Permanis decided, throw it all on one sandwich.
Pastrami,
so it's
French fries, coleslaw, heart attack, everything you need.
On rye bread. On marbled rye.
Everything to keep a growing boy healthy. I think now they actually throw some blood pressure medication on it.
Yeah, I think you need 12 hours of hard labor to burn off that entire sandwich.
Somebody's like, can I get that gluten-free? Sheesh.
Yeah, it does not come gluten-free.
No, you're not getting it gluten-free. Can I get that vegan?
Not exactly. So I thought this was a really good article to bring up in our oil and natural gas segment because of the tumultuous week that we've had in the market that we just talked about last segment. And he had talked about, since we are in correction territory, the last 10 out of 11 recessions that we've had.
So that's a pretty good percentage.
Pretty high percentage, yeah. Were associated with oil price spikes. And the last several weeks, we've been talking about the room that oil has had between 60 and all the way up to 80, which is the $80 a barrel. And that was on light sweet crude, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Where there's a fair price area up to about 80. And we've talked about why those prices have stayed, where they are. And oil has been rising a bit, over the last couple of weeks. And so in this particular article, it talks about the quote, keep it in the ground movement. Now, President Trump has just in the last 3 weeks has kind of unleashed domestic drilling and pulling resources, from the ground. And our consumption and demand for oil and natural gas continues to rise. The estimate for oil consumption worldwide has increased to, I believe it was 1.3 million barrels per day. Is it 1.3? Yeah, it is 1.3 million barrels per day. And it's going to continue to increase, from there.
Well, and especially when you have so much opening in the drilling cycle, right? There's so many more opportunities to drill. When President Trump opened all that information up and said, okay, now here's some areas that we can drill. And you know, we're not being political on the show. We're just stating the fact that agree or disagree, that's what happened.
Right. And so, and it affects prices.
And that's going to affect prices. Although mm-hmm. this week we saw, you know, recently we saw oil go from, now get this, by the way, it hit a high of 66.66 mm-hmm. and came down under $60 a barrel. So a 10% drop in the price of oil very, very, very quickly.
Which is very interesting because on Monday the market dropped 666 points.
Yeah, just saying. Just saying.
Just saying.
So, you know, the oil that has...
Numbers matter, people.
Numbers matter. So as it fell to under $60 a barrel, you know, there's always a reason why. There's always a reason as to here's why it fell. Here's what happened. You know, there was a sparrow that sang the wrong tune in Saudi Arabia. Whatever it is, it's demand and supply. And there was no pent up demand at any of those higher price points where price has recently, you know, risen from. And you're going to start to see some more demand creeping in. You know, there's some pretty solid demand creeping in at about $55, well, call it $57 a barrel, $57.50, kind of in that range. And I'm looking at the March futures contract here, but it's going to be in that range that we start to see a little bit more demand kind of creeping back in.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this movement of, you know, keep it in the ground, it doesn't even really make all that much sense from a usage perspective, not from an environmental perspective. We don't talk about that kind of stuff on this particular show, but we do talk about usage and the numbers and the quantitative analysis of it all. And so, you know, when we talk about usage, we look at the percentage of use over the last decade or so. And domestically, we're at least 50% higher than the national average, and industrial rates are actually more than double of what they were a decade ago. And so when you have specifically this particular article talked about the New England and New York areas, and so when you have that demand, it's of more than double, it's going to drive up prices, and it's actually encouraging companies to leave the area.
Well, you know, I think specifically about New England and New York. Every time I went to New York for the past couple of years, every time I would go there, there was always some sort of a rally, stop the pipeline, no drilling. And they just didn't want that natural gas pipeline. But interestingly enough, New York and New England are the areas that are consuming the most natural gas.
They are. And natural gas is at historic prices or historic low prices for natural gas. Anyway, and so those low prices, when things are priced low, people tend to use
more of it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So
the low prices actually encourage more usage anyway.
So kind of it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy at that point. It is really what it does. And so what does that mean locally, right? What does that mean on the smaller side? Well, as the oil prices, and now we saw some oil stocks, some very big name oil stocks, not the least of which being ExxonMobil. Holy skadoosh, did ExxonMobil take a hit. ExxonMobil did worse than the overall market by a significant amount, going from $89 a share all the way down to as low as $73.95 a share.
I think you just said significant.
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 That's what I said.
No, there's a C-A-N-T at the end of that word.
No, significant.
No, you said significant. That was fine. But then you said significant. I don't think that's the word.
Stop it.
Silently correct your grammar.
Stop it. You're not silently correcting my grammar.
Not so silently.
Anyway, ExxonMobil took a heck of a, I'm going to use the word heck of a, took a heck of a, took a heck of a fall from $89 a share
now
down.
Now he's Emerson making up his own words.
To around $74 a share. And if you're going to go from $89 a share to $74, that's a big move.
Yeah.
Right? You had a huge drop off in ExxonMobil. How about companies like Chevron? Chevron went from roughly $133 a share all the way down to $110. So you got some really big sell-offs in ExxonMobil, in Chevron, You know, Royal Dutch Shell is another one. Took a little bit of a hit. You had a couple of big name energy stocks that came down pretty hard. BP from $44 a share all the way down to as low as 36. So these, if we do believe that oil does have room to rise, which I think that it does long term, could become a value investor's opportunity somewhere down in these price points.
Yeah, and I think that's clear because the U.S. economy and the global economy, when you look at the fundamentals, we look at the tax cuts, we look at jobs and economic policies of the rising inflation of the dollar, which is not such a bad thing, depending on the pace at which it's set. And also the fiscal and monetary policies of increasing exports and things of that nature. Like, economically, things are looking good. When things look good like that, it's obviously going to demand more oil and gas. And the U.S. and global economies were supplying over 60% of all energy. And so as that grows, so does the demand for oil and natural gas. And as the demand grows, those stocks should continue to rise. And as you said, there is room to rise up to about 80. And as I've said before too, the oil and gas companies, I think, are also sensitive to the fact that consumers do start to make different decisions in their buying habits at certain price points. So I think that they are, I think it was last show we talked about price manipulation in the oil industries. And so I think they are careful as to how much oil is going to rise at the same time.
Well, and it always comes back to having a good, solid investment plan about how you handle these particular items in your portfolio. Should you avoid them in your portfolio? Not necessarily. But are they for everybody? Not necessarily. And the thing to remember is that everybody should have their own individualized plan. If you don't have a plan, it's one of those things. I like the old Patton quote that says, a good plan violently executed today is better than a perfect plan executed next week. So thanks for listening to Chuck and Ann on Finance. If you guys have any questions, feel free to shoot us an email, chuck@iiefinancial.com, or visit us online, iiefinancial.com. We will see you soon. Thanks so much. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chuck and Ann on Finance. Hope everybody's having an absolutely amazing day as we are getting ready to rock and roll with another one of our District 2 congressional candidates. Rick Walker is joining us, and Rick brings a pretty unique perspective on government because he's got a lot of business experience, and that business experience is also coupled with some pretty strong international ties, which I think are kind of unique and something that is awesome to talk about here on Chuck and Anna Finance. So, Rick, welcome to the show. Glad to have you.
Chuck and Anna, thanks so much for having us.
So, getting rolling, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself? Why don't, people that maybe haven't had a chance to meet you. I mean, I will tell you, I can't drive about 4 miles where we live without seeing your sign, which is awesome. So let people know a little bit about you, if that's all right.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Well, Chuck and Anna, thanks again for having me. I grew up down in South Texas, and we grew up fairly poor, two-bedroom house. My dad was out of work most of the time we were growing up, and my mom, I consequently had to work double jobs. And when I was 18, I wanted to start a business. And my mom, she had $1,000 left. It's all she had. She entrusted that to me and said, go see what we can make happen. And so consequently, over about a 10-year period, I grew a business up into a multi-million dollar range and created hundreds of jobs. And when I was in my mid-20s, I also started taking on some nonprofit work, and eventually came in leadership to with a global organization, eventually becoming their chairman. And I scaled that under my leadership from a few hundred employees up to in excess of 2,000 people working in 50 countries.
Wow.
And so I did that simultaneously to running the business. And so I'm 39. I've been running the business since I was 18. So I've got 20 years of business experience there. I've got a decade of global governance experience. I also do a lot of work with the National Christian Foundation, where I serve on their board. We deploy between $50 and $100 million a year to charities and churches in the greater Houston area. And I also have some other board assignments that we can talk about a little bit later on. But for the most part, I understand the economic concerns of the folks here in Congressional District 2. And as someone that's been an entrepreneur that's created more jobs than all other eight candidates combined, I understand what it takes to maintain a firm and stable and growing job base.
Yeah, that really speaks to, I think, why it seems like you are wanting to, you know, to run for this position in the House. I was wondering if you could maybe narrow down specifically two things that really motivated you to run. What are they?
Well, I'll give you three things, Ann. Their names are Emerson, Charlotte, Rose, and Lily Kate, my three daughters. We do not see anyone in Washington, D.C. making decisions for 20 or 30 years from now. No one's making decisions that are going to benefit our kids and our grandkids. What they're doing is they're making decisions that's going to keep them in office right now and making decisions which help them accrue seniority and fundraise so they can stay in power. They are, the people that are in D.C. are making decisions not in our best interest, but in their own best interest. And so my wife, Shannon, and I, we talked about it, and we talked about the fact that there's essentially a war on children that's happening. There's a war on children in the womb. We're very, very pro-life. There's a war on children in the pocketbook. The out-of-control bureaucratic spending gives each child that's born today approximately $70,000 in their pro-rata share of debt that they either have to pay off during their lifetimes or pass it on to their heirs. And there's also a war on children in the classrooms. In certain parts of the country, there are out-of-control teachers' unions that are teaching children just disgustingly left-wing radical sexual agendas at really very, very immature ages. And so we think those three things and other things that are happening to our children, that someone needs to go to Washington, D.C. to fight back, and we're prepared to go and fight back.
Well, whenever your why happens to be your kids, that seems to make things a bit stronger, doesn't it?
That's right. And you have that built-in guarantee, Chuck, that you're not going to sell your own kids out.
Yeah.
And so when you go and you say that's why we're going, that's why we're going. And there's no second guessing. There's no negotiating out of it. There's no one's going to say, hey, Rick, but if you do this, you do that. There's no qualms about I'm in this for my kids and I will not sell my kids out. And so if I won't sell my kids out, I'm also not going to sell your kids and your grandkids out.
Well, you know, that you mentioned the idea that people are doing it for what's happening today, right? To maintain an office, to maintain kind of that power base and not looking down the road. That kind of brings me to the concept of a lot of what's happening with the economy today, and not just fiscally, but also, not just in the government spending, but also just in the fiscal monetary policy. What's your thought on, you know, the need of the Fed to raise interest rates in this current economic climate? You know, we're starting to see a little bit of inflation creep in. We saw some pretty extreme volatility in the markets here, pretty early in February that essentially erased 2 months worth of market gains. What's your thoughts on the Fed's need to raise those rates in our current economic positions?
Well, so I'm a free market capitalist. I believe that the Fed really has shouldn't have no role in our economy. You look at the quantitative easing, QE 1, 2, and 3 from the last few years. We see this falsification of the capital that they're making available to small businesses through their QE process and working through the big banks to provide more capital. We think that's an artificial inflation that while the market is underperforming where the Fed's trying to get it. Whenever you get you have essentially a crossover where the Fed is operating at a level lower, and it'll eventually drag the market down. So I think that the stimulus that the Fed's trying to provide and the overcorrection through the raising and the lowering of interest rates, it needs to stop. And I think that we just have to get to the place in our society that we realize that businesses over the long term are going to have to stand on their own, and the federal government should not have a role in trying to correct artificially inflate or deflate the economy to get it slowed down or speed up. You know, one of the big things, Chuck and Ann, that I believe is that for too long we've allowed our government to artificially influence different sections of our economy. You look at the healthcare market. You know, 2 years ago we were saying, well, you know, the government's influencing approximately a sixth of the economy. Well, now they're influencing a fifth of the economy. That's how that's more expensive and expansive the healthcare market's gotten.
I'm sometimes surprised it's only that small.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be 50% of the economy, especially for Social Security recipients here in a few years. It's going to take up half of their Social Security check.
Yeah.
It's just really an absolute shame. And so we've got to pull the federal government back. We've got to restrain the federal government and allow decision making to flow back to the states and to the local economies and let free market capitalism reign once again.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about the local economies and as it compares to the government. And when the government reports unemployment rates, right? It's reporting that we have, one of the lowest employment rates in a really long time. But there's a disconnect between the unemployment rate and the labor force participation rate. So our unemployment rate is showing that we're at quote unquote full employment, end quote. But according to the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, we have the lowest workforce participation rate since 1978. So can you want to comment a little bit on the differences between those and why you think that might be and what types of things that you would like to see happen to get more participation in the workforce?
Sure. So I think you're referring to the two most common measures that we use in our business is the U3 and the U6 rates. The U3 rates right now, I believe, are somewhere around 4%, 4.1%, and the U6 rates are probably closer to 8% or 8.1%. Here in Texas, a little bit better than that. I think the U3 rate, which that's the rate that I like to use for decision-making in my personal business, is probably close to 3.7, 3.8 right now. And we'll get some more updated numbers over the next couple of weeks.
Right.
So what we believe, this is just me as an entrepreneur, not me as a politician. The people that do not want to work are people that I do not want to work for me. And that's a little bit of a big differentiator, because when you see that delta, when you jump out from the 4% up to the 8%, you say, well, there's 4% people there that could work, but they're just not wanting to work, or they're just somewhat they're just minimally involved in trying to get jobs. Those are the people in my company that I don't want there, because right. they for the most part are not hard workers. And now there's a few exceptions to that, but for the most part, we want to go after people that currently have jobs. Now, so what I believe we've got to do is we've got to expand the skilled worker base here in the United States. We've got to get better communication between businesses and colleges, businesses and high schools. And you look at Humble ISD in our area; they have a fantastic trades program. They have, I think, 14,000 students that are signed up to learn technical trades, things like car repair and wood shop. And you can even, as an 18-year-old in an Humble ISD high school, you can go and get your real estate license and go to work immediately after high school.
Right.
That's very, very smart. That's the future. That's where our workforce needs to go, so that we have full communication between the employer base and the schools. And the students actually know that if I study this or if I get a license at this, I've got a job waiting for me on the other side of that. So this long way to say that this U3, U6, U1, whatever rate you want to use, this is a story about talent and access to talent for businesses. We've got to get better talent. We've got to get better skills for our kids and the people that are entering the workforce. We've got to get better talent even for people that are ending prison terms and coming out. We've got to get reduced recidivism by getting people that are in prison skills training.
Right.
So that when they come out, they can contribute to our society and to our economy.
So, right, real quick, Rick, if I could interrupt you real quick, we're gonna have to cut this short off the radio portion of the interview for you guys to listen to the rest of. I'm gonna ask Rick a couple of questions specifically around budget and maybe some immigration and how it's going to affect our budgetary policies. But go to Chuck and Ann on Finance. You can go to IIEfinancial.com and listen to us there, or you can just find our podcast. So Rick, real quick, thanks for taking the time a little bit longer. You mentioned a lot about the schools, and I think that the schools are an absolutely humongous thing. And you also talked about people kind of coming out of the prisons and getting back into the workforce. And that, I always look at that BLS statistic, Bureau of Labor Statistics, that labor force participation rate. I mean, when I looked at that and saw that it was lowest that it's been since the late 70s, it was kind of eye-opening to me. It really was. What do you think that immigration, our current immigration policy, how do you see that affecting small businesses in our district? And if I gave you a magic wand, what would your immigration policy be and how would it affect small businesses, especially in our area?
Okay, good question. So we have a cascading problem. When the larger businesses or the more well-capitalized businesses can't get talent, they suck up the talent from the mid-cap, the mid-sized businesses and the small businesses. It cascades up, it cascades down, depending on the flow of talent, the flow of labor in our markets. We have a problem right now with the highly skilled H-1B visa program. It gets maxed out continuously, and we have a federal cap of 85,000 per year. That's not enough talent to keep the American engine moving. We want, and my recommendation is that we expand that highly skilled, that highly merit-based immigration program, the H-1B program, from 85,000 a year to 250,000 a year. Now, currently, most of that 85,000 is getting absorbed with computer-related jobs. We need to be able to bring in medical researchers, big data scientists, biotech. We've got to bring in people from a number of industries, not just computer-related services. And so when we expand that from 85,000 a year to 250,000 people a year, we bring these immigrants to our country that are going to pay taxes here instead of paying taxes other places. They're going to start businesses here in the United States instead of paying and starting investing businesses overseas. And we're going to bring that talent here. And this is part of my plan. We call it economic offense. We've been playing economic defense for way too long. Now it's time to go on economic offense. And that's what we're going to do. The H-1B visa program is critical to that. So what happens whenever the very well-capitalized companies that are at the top of our food chain, the Fortune 500 companies, have enough talent there, the less adequate, maybe higher paid talent can flow down to mid-cap companies and small companies, and we grow the economy as a whole.
That's awesome. I think that a lot of people don't look at the visa status. You know, a lot of people just think about, when they think about immigration, they think about illegal immigration without really thinking about legal immigration. And some of the smartest and best people that I've worked with have been, you know, that they've worked here on legal immigration status with the visa. So, you know, I want to transition, if I can, real quick. We got just a couple of minutes left. But specifically, you know, this week we had our 9-hour government shutdown. And a lot of that was built around the budgetary spending and really what budgets are. And Annie has a pretty unique situation and kind of story that I think is that I can't relate to as well as she did because she's actually lived it. But I'd like to get your opinion on something that as a business owner, you should completely understand. So Annie, go ahead and lead into it if that's all right.
Yeah. So in a former life, I was a mechanical engineer and worked for NASA and I worked for a government contractor. And when I was submitting my budgets every year, if I didn't use my entire budget for that particular year, the next year I was penalized for not using it. And so it would either be greatly reduced or, you know, further scrutinized or whatever, but mostly penalized. And so I was wondering what your thoughts are on that. And do you see it changing if you want it to change? You know, how you feel about that whole system?
About the whole government spending system, or
about the budgetary process, yes. In terms of, like, if you know you're a business owner, so if you ran your business where people weren't spending every dime you gave them, you'd be bankrupt within a year, right?
That's right.
So, so our government doesn't work that way. When people are submitting budgets, if they don't use the entire budget for a particular year, they're penalized, you know, for not using that. So. I just was wondering what your thoughts were on that, if you see that system changing, because in my opinion and experience, is extraordinarily wasteful.
That's right. That's right. So I'm a big advocate of something called zero-based budgeting, that every year you start at zero and you build up your budget rather than starting where you were before and adding or reducing from there. We solve a lot of problems by implementing zero-based budgeting, and I think it's a smart way to move. The additional spending that occurred as a result of this really just a poorly negotiated government shutdown, you know, you got to increase the discretionary spending by $300 billion. You have interest payments that have increased. So that $300 billion essentially becomes $420 billion over time.
Right.
And it's just not very responsible. It's not very responsible. We don't have a tax problem like a lot of folks that are on the left say. We have a spending problem. It's got to be controlled. You look at our own community, they got hit with the flooding and the $90 billion that that was received for Texas, Florida, Puerto Rico, and California. That's great. That needs to happen. But the problem is you've got Houston as one of the primary economic engines of the whole United States, and we've got to split $90 billion with these other three territories. It's ridiculous. We're going to have to go back to Congress over and over and over again until we get enough money to be able to correct the problems. And for those that are in Northeast Harris County, that $90 billion, we're probably not going to get a penny of that.
Nothing.
And so we have to realign our expectations of what government should be. Federico Bastiat said that the federal government and law should only encompass three things: the protection of property, persons, and liberty. That's all. And the government's doing way too much, and that's why we have a spending problem.
Yeah, you know, I just when I first heard her tell me that story, I know that you get rewarded for coming in under budget in every other business on the planet, yet you get punished for coming in under budget in a government business. So, well, Rick, we've got about a minute and a half left. What I wanted to do was just, you know, if there's anything that you would like people to know, kind of what your thoughts are, and just sum up, you know, what would you like people to know, and kind of as a final takeaway as they start to head out into the polls and start to look into whose button they're going to push, you know, heading into the elections.
Well, thanks, Chuck. So we have a very, very crowded field. There's 9 candidates in this race. I'm the only candidate from the Humboldt Kingwood area that just got absolutely devastated by the flooding. Our home flooded. So did hundreds of our neighbors. And so that's a very, very concern. In our area of the woods, also Addicks and Barker's area, Meyerland, these are all in this district. And so what we believe is that we need someone that's confident that'll go to Washington. My primary challenger is a lady who's essentially trying to buy a congressional seat. This is a woman that on her last 10 years federal reports for giving, she's listed herself as a homemaker, yet she spent $2.5 million on commercials running as a tech executive. There aren't enough dollars to go up against that. And so what we need for people to do is realize that you got to go look at a resume. If Kennedy doesn't have a resume on their website, there's something wrong. That should be a big red flag. And we've got to stop people that try to come in and try to buy congressional seats. As I mentioned, in my 20s, I created hundreds of jobs. In my 30s, I scaled a global organization from a few hundred to over 2,000 staff in 50 countries, Russia, China, India, Mexico. I understand the way the world works. I also serve on the board of a seminary in the Middle East, where we bestow Masters of Divinity degrees to get folks to go out and plant churches throughout the Middle East in very, very difficult areas. I understand the way the world works. I understand the way the economy works. I'm a deacon at Kingwood First Baptist. I understand what the moral compass should be for a person that's in Congress and a person that's in the leadership. I've lived my whole life, and I'm ready to go to Washington, D.C. to lead for the constituents of Congressional District 2. And I just encourage folks to get out there and vote. Don't let someone buy your vote. If you've seen them on TV, look up their record. Ask for a resume. Google them. Please, please, please Google the candidates. You've got to Google the candidates. There are very, very significant issues out there that obviously the candidates that are trying to buy their way into it are trying to cover up. Go Google Kathleen Wall. Google me and find out the difference.
Awesome, Rick. Well, hey, thank you so much for the time. We really appreciate it. We're glad that you're able to come on the show for a little bit. And I think that all our listeners appreciate a lot of what you've done. And certainly as you continue rebuilding from the flood, and I know you got damaged pretty good, that we keep you in our prayers, and certainly I'm sure everybody else does as well. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Right, thanks so much. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.
You too. IIE Financial is an investment advisor representative with Symphony Financial, a registered investment advisor. Charles Fulkerson is an investment advisor representative with IIE Financial and Symphony Financial, LTD Co. Annie Fulkerson is not registered nor affiliated with Symphony Financial. Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of Symphony Financial. The topics discussed and opinions given are not intended to address the specific needs of any listener. IIE Financial does not offer legal or tax advice. Listeners are encouraged to discuss their financial needs with the appropriate professional regarding your individual circumstance.